So the first reading is from Matthew 27, starting at verse 27. That's page 999. So Matthew 27, starting at verse 27. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers round him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spat on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink, mixed with gall. But after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You, who were going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He can't save others," they said. He saved others, they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him.
The real shock of verses 27 to 31 isn't what the soldiers are doing so much as who it is that they're doing it to. Of course, what they're doing is shocking as well, isn't it? Shouldn't happen ever, this kind of cruelty or abuse of power, but you don't have to look very hard to realise how often it does. Jesus has just been condemned to be crucified and flogged, verse 26 tells us, just before where we began that reading. So his back has been shredded by a whip. And now here he stands, surrounded by a whole company of soldiers, so up to 600 of them. He's stripped, he's dressed up, he's mocked. They spit on him, such is their contempt. And then he's beaten too, again and again. And there's even more torment in verse 34 as they finally reach the place where he'll be crucified. "Do you want a drink, Jesus?" they say. "Is this a moment of kindness?" Then we realise, no, it's undrinkable. It's been spiked with gall. He's robbed of his clothes. Most of our pictures of the crucifixion shy away from the fact that Jesus, like all victims of crucifixion, was almost certainly naked as he died. Utter indignity. Crucified between two robbers, the one who began his life surrounded by animals ends it in the company of criminals. And then more insults and derision, you notice, from the passers-by, verses 39 to 40, then the religious leaders, and then even those he's crucified with, they start piling in on him too. And behind all that human hostility, an even greater opponent. We catch just a glimpse of that in the words of the passers-by at the end of verse 40. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God. You think, who else in Jesus' life has come at him saying something like that? If you really are God's Son, prove it by doing this thing I'm telling you to do. Satan himself in the wilderness. Do you remember really going for Jesus at the start of his ministry? And here he is now, still really going at him, right at the end as well. It's hard reading, isn't it, those verses Frankie just read? You see a trial going on in a crown court somewhere, perhaps. And hear on the news of the forensic recounting of just all the awful things that were done to someone as they were cruelly killed. And you think of the family of that poor person sat in the court day by day, just listening to that stuff being recounted. Hearing of someone they love so much having gone through that. And it's a little bit like that for us here, isn't it? Because this is Jesus, who we love. They did this to him. Do we need the details? But there is such comfort in them, isn't there? In all of them. We've ever found ourselves the victim of a genuine abuse of power, or being ridiculed, perhaps, or treated with contempt, or hurt, or tormented, or robbed, or shamed, or insulted, or mocked, or misunderstood. We have a friend in heaven who gets it. He knows exactly what it's like, because he's been on the end of all of that too. Not just a friend, though, because who else is he? Well, he's a king, Matthew wants us to see. You see how it keeps coming out in those verses? It's one of the features of Matthew's account, how the lower Jesus goes in his suffering, the higher the kind of language that's used to describe him. Over and over again, we keep being reminded, this is the king. So you see what the soldiers dress him at. They mean it as a joke, don't they? But they're dressing him up as a king. Hail, King of the Jews, they say as they kneel before him. There's sarcasm from them, but they're speaking so much better than they know. And then the written charge above his head on the cross, verse 37. You see what it says? This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. It's Pilate's last dig at the Jews. He's the King of Israel, the chief priests and the elders. The teachers of the law say in verse 42, but again, all speaking so much better than they know. Remember just under 11 months ago, most of us, we settled back on our sofas, didn't we, to watch a coronation, the only coronation most of us have seen in our lifetime so far. That moment Charles had been waiting for, building up to all his life, and what a day it was. Such pomp and glamour and pageantry and majesty and power. Here's Jesus at the moment he's been waiting for all his life. Imagine him realizing this is what's coming his way as he pores over the scriptures. And then doesn't deviate away from it, but heads resolutely towards it. No pomp, no glamour, no pageantry, no obvious signs of majesty or power. Quite the opposite, in fact, isn't it? But look, says Matthew, don't you see who he is? The king who comes not to be served but to serve and to give his life to rescue people like us. A king who, despite those mocking cries, does not come down from the cross and save himself. Who, even though he does trust God, is not rescued by him in this moment, because he knows this is what he's come to do for you. You can try to say, not my king, about Charles, I suppose, if you want to. Why would we ever want to do it about Jesus, though? What a king. Let's be quiet together now.
We're going to be continuing reading in Matthew 27, starting at verse 45. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those who were with him, guarding Jesus, saw the earthquake and all that happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." Many women were there, watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Jose, and the mother of Zebedee's sons.
So 3 hours of darkness, right in the middle of the day. And any clued up person who knew their Old Testament would have known immediately exactly what that meant. God was angry. They would have known the story of the plague of darkness in Egypt just before the Exodus, the way the prophet Amos talks about darkness being a sign of God's judgment as well. So here we go again, God pouring his judgment down. And no wonder, we might think, because after all, look what people are doing to his son. Now, what father wouldn't be furious to see people treating his much-loved son like this? But then Jesus cries out this great cry in verse 46, and suddenly we have to think again, don't we? "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And suddenly the awful and yet wonderful truth of what is going on becomes clearer, doesn't it? This darkness is a sign of God's anger and God's fury. God's right judgment of sin being directed not at those doing the crucifying, but at the one being crucified. Like the rays of the sun being focused in by a magnifying glass, poured down on that figure on the middle cross. The worst part of Jesus' suffering, not the physical pain, although that was off the scale, not the shame or the ridicule, although that was off the scale as well, but being judged and forsaken by his Father as the one perfect human being in those moments at the cross, absorbing in his person all the fury, the right judgment that our rebellion against God deserves. If we trust him, Jesus takes it all, every last bit of it, taken by him, so we can go free. And just before we maybe fall into the trap of thinking this is something that poor helpless Jesus has been forced into against his will, some scheme of his father's, well, do notice verse 50. When Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. He dies, you notice, not with a whimper, but with a roar. Not the barely audible croak of a victim, but the shout of a victor. He doesn't lose his spirit. He gives it up. as he willingly gives himself to die in our place. And what an outcome as well. You know, why was Jesus crucified? Why did Jesus die, people ask sometimes? Well, have a look and see what happens next. Immediately, verse 51, the way to God opened wide. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. That great curtain in the temple that was such a barrier, a massive great no entry sign, saying to people like us, keep out, you can't come into the place in the temple where God said he was especially present. Now suddenly, by God's own hand, from top to bottom, it's torn in two, it's destroyed, because Jesus' death, which removes and completely deals with our sins, means anyone who trusts him is welcome into God's presence again. And then new life beyond the grave as well, not just for Jesus 2 days later, but for all his people as well. We get that mysterious account, it's only in Matthew's version, verses 52 and 53, of other holy people, so people who look to the Lord, being raised from the dead as well. And it's so weird, isn't it? It's almost a bit embarrassing, we find it these days, but there it is. This intriguing early glimpse of what Jesus one day promises will be true for all those who trust him as well. And then verse 54. Do we see here faith? A sign of faith in the most surprising places and from the most surprising people of all. This centurion and those with him, which I take it is referring to the whole squad of soldiers, probably four of them, who've just done the grisly business of carrying out these three crucifixions. The very people at whose hands Jesus has died, seeing who he is and confessing it too. Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Luke tells us Jesus prayed for those who were nailing him to that cross. Is this exclamation, surely he was the Son of God, maybe evidence that prayer was answered very quickly indeed? There's a real encouragement there, isn't there, to keep on praying for others, even those who look to us like the least likely converts of all. None of them, no one, beyond the reach of the power and mercy and grace that we see in Jesus here at the cross. Be quiet again.
Third reading is from Matthew chapter 27 and verses 57 to 66 on page 1000. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there, opposite the tomb. The next day, the one after Preparation Day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first."